Welcome to Motivated to Lead Podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingenstein.
Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us for our podcast this week. My name is Mark Klingenstein with SEMA Partners. Each week, we interview leaders and they share lessons learned from their careers. Our goal is to help you become a better leader. This week, we're going to revisit a conversation that we had some time ago with Stephen Quast. Stephen is the CEO of Space Built. He's a retired Air Force general who has spent his life understanding the art of peaceful international affairs and national security strategies. And he's a graduate of the United States Air Force Academy. He holds a master's degree in public policy from Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He's had an extensive background in recruiting, educating, training, and developing the workforce for the U.S. Air Force. He was the university president for Air Forces University, and he's a combat seasoned fighter pilot with extensive command experience at every level in the U.S. Air Force. Looking forward to today's conversation with Stephen. First off, Steve, can you give us just a little bit of your career story, a little bit of your history?
Yeah, so in most cases, people's history, have events that are their fault and events that are not their fault, and all of them make you into the person you are. So I was lucky enough to be raised in Africa. My parents were missionaries and cultural anthropologists. And so I didn't have to go to school for the first 10 years, which was really fun until I got back to America and had to go to school. Always thought that I would go in as a missionary pilot because I love flying. And then I found the passion of leading and flying. And the Air Force was willing to pay for my college, which I couldn't afford. So luck and happenstance, I thought I'd just be in enough to get a little flying in and then go into the mission field. But it turns out the Air Force was my mission field, and the rest is history. So in the Air Force, I've been able to lead through multiple different entities, whether it was combat units, administrative units. I was a university president at one point, acquisition requirements, training, education, recruiting. So leading enterprises in all those areas. And then now I'm the president of a startup company that, in fact, just won Startup of the Year for America. And so now I'm leading as the president of that company. So I've been fortunate enough to have a very large and diverse set of leadership experiences, not due to my own fault, just due to luck and timing in life.
Well, that's a great story. You've got every chapter. It'd be great to talk in depth about, but we're going to be kind of talking about some of your thoughts around leadership. And we have a number of new leaders that are either first-time CEOs or first-time leaders of teams, and definitely looking forward to your thoughts around leadership. I like to ask this question of almost every guest that we have on is, knowing what you know now, what advice would you have given yourself at the age of 22?
Yeah, the advice I would give is don't try to do it all yourself. Build a team of people that do it together. It's a much easier road, and it's much more fun.
Any advice that you received early on that, looking back, you should have ignored?
I think the advice that driving a hard-nosed approach to getting things done is the way to go. What I found is that people are stubborn and they are not going to do something if they don't want to do it. So the art of inspiring and incentivizing people to do something because they want to do it, not because you told them to do it or because your vision is the right vision. First making sure the people know that you care about them, and then they start caring about what it is you want them to do.
What are some, there's always leadership lessons you wish you would have known earlier. Anything that stands out that you wish you've, around people, leadership, or?
Yeah, it probably goes around trust, meaning, when I was a younger leader, there would be a task at hand and I would think to myself, well, I can get that done quick. I know I can do a good job. I'll just do it. And in some bizarre way, I thought I was being helpful. because I was doing a job that otherwise somebody else might do. And I learned pretty quick and later than I wanted to that you, when you do that, you steal away the opportunity for somebody else to do something that's important and to help them learn. And so building this trust where you have to be willing to let them fail or not do the job as well as you thought it might be done, but you lose out on building that trust with people where they trust you because you trust them and you work it out together. So people who are driven that perfection is the standard and I'm not going to let anybody else do it. I'm going to do it because I think I can do it as close to perfect as possible is really a poison pill for the kind of trust you need to build in a team if you're going to do anything really meaningful.
So moving from the military and having led large groups, how many people did you lead at one point that were under your command?
Well, different commands, different sizes. So, for example, when I was commander of Air University, there were probably 260,000 people. Many of them were in student status. In Air Education and Training Command, where you're in charge of all training, recruiting, and education, again, depending on the student status, it could be pretty large. But 64,000 direct, in the direct chain of command, and then all of the students that are part of that broader team would ebb and flow into the hundreds of thousands.
So talk about moving from the military into now you're an entrepreneur, and I'm sure you considered yourself an entrepreneur, even though you were in the military, you were coming up with innovative ideas and thoughts around education as well as the other things that you did. But how has that transition been as far as moving and what do you wish you had known now that you're in the...
Yeah. So I think that the good news is that leadership, to overuse an analogy, leadership is like the game of golf. If you get the principles down, if you get the swing down, then it's just a matter of picking the right club and using the same swing, and you get it to go in the right spot. So all of the principles that I was able to learn through the School of Hard Knocks or through failure or whatever it might be in the military have really served me well in civil society and in the private sector. I will say that the private sector is easier to lead in regards to innovation because the military is so bureaucratic and it is very status quo and it's subordinated. It's trying to drive risk out of what you're doing, and that can make it very difficult to innovate. So I've really enjoyed the private sector because we're able to take more prudent risk, and we've been able to discover more rapidly. As we all know, risk and reward are two sides of the same coin, and you have to balance that. It's easier to balance that in the outside and then in the military, where you have such a intricate tangle of regulatory and statutory boundaries that have grown up over the years. Because every time somebody makes a mistake, Congress throws a law or a policy or a regulation on you, and it becomes more and more entangled.
Talk a little bit about your new venture. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing.
Well, like in most cases, I had nothing to do with that. It's outsiders that vote, and I'm just one piece of a team here. Dr. Stuckenberg and Shannon Stuckenberg are the founders and creators of the company. But it's essentially a strategist in Dr. Stuckenberg that can see that the human race is going to need a different relationship with water if we're going to move forward. Because water scarcity is becoming more and more prevalent as more and more people are on the planet and as people want more and more things, because everything produced has a water footprint. Like the shirt I'm wearing is about 600 gallons to make. Most people don't realize this, but 1 gallon of Coke takes 406 gallons of water to make 1 gallon of Coke. So everything we love takes water to make. And as he saw this this crisis emerging, he got together some of the most renowned scientists and engineers on the planet, and he has a natural network. And they basically have refined and broken through on an invention that can take water out of the air that's all around you right now, but can bring it out in a responsible way so you can drink that water or use it to grow plants or to do anything you want, and it's affordable. Versus before this technique of a liquid to do that work, people would air condition, and that is very expensive. You know, a dehumidifier takes a lot of energy to get even a thimble full of water. So that was that's the main thing of this company, is that we've broken the sound barrier twice. Once where we figured out how to do this so you can get mass water out of the air. And the second is the energy, where we can do it for affordable energy prices.
Wow. That sounds like a game changer as far as in all the areas that that are needing that. So you're now working with a board. Any thoughts around that as far as, is that a new experience, or have you worked with other boards?
No, this idea where you learn from others and you have a large team of people that give you advice is really, really important. It goes back to that first principle I talked about, where get a lot of friends, you know, and the smarter your friends are, the better. And then tell them everything you're doing and let them talk to you and be humble enough to listen, learn, and change your mind. So I've done that my whole life. When I was a university president, I had a board of, a board of visitors, which is basically a board of directors. Sure. And so this is nothing new, and it's a blessing, because the board of directors and the board of advisors we have at Genesis Systems, for example, are former governors, former directors of the CIA, former general officers and admirals, former CEOs, bankers from Goldman Sachs, and all these amazing heavy hitters that have been CEOs of multiple companies that are global. And I get to get that inside information where I say, hey, I'm struggling with this little tiny problem, and they can help me not make the same mistakes they've made.
Talk a little bit about your decision-making process. I'm always curious of people that have led people, especially in crisis or in pressure packed times. Talk a little bit about your process and what you've taught.
Yeah, that's a great question, because the mental approach that you make decisions with is really, really important. Most people think that if you just look at the facts closely enough, look at the data clearly enough, that the decision will emerge, and that is a path to success. And that is historically wrong. People can make facts say anything, and the data can be amalgamated to basically point you into any direction. So there are clever people that make a living on providing you data that leads you right where they want you to go. That's not decision-making. That's blindly doing things other people tell you to do. Leaders are the ones that set a vision and then take you in a direction that makes what you're doing more useful and more novel, meaning it's new. So the first thing about decision-making is surrounding yourself with very smart people that are creative and that can see a problem through many different lenses. And I would characterize it as holistic systemic thinkers. And then as a leader, you have to have this intellectual curiosity where you care about everything. And then this voracious appetite of being an aggressive learner, where you're willing to sit down and learn something. And what you find is even an aggressive learner, even with a few hours, can learn something because of the internet and the access to information that makes them more knowledgeable on that subject than most people on the planet, save for the PhDs and the people that do it for a living. So this is a great secret of decision making. So I'll bring this to a finer point on decision-making, but the first is to surround yourself with really smart people that are also intellectually curious and aggressive learners, and then have them bring you opinions about what you do about this data and what it says. you have to start with an opinion. You cannot start with a blank mind saying, I don't have any opinion on what this decision should be. I just want to see the data. Because if you do that, you will always perpetuate the past and you will never pioneer new journeys. And the hallmark of a great leader is setting vision and moving humanity forward, uplifting the human condition and making things better, no matter what the enterprise it is you're putting your hand to, whether it's national security, education, industry, faith, morality. And so the essence of decision making is this team of people that actually have an opinion and then use the scientific method to prove that opinion wrong. And aggressively learn and then take risks to try things and fail until you succeed.
Yeah, great, great advice, great thoughts around decision-making. Any books that you recommend to leaders that you would recommend for them to read?
Well, yeah, that's one of those classic questions because there's thousands of them out there. You know, there's nothing new under the sun. And smart human beings have been thinking about this art of leadership since the beginning. And many of them have written just very powerful descriptions of how you do it. So I'll give you two very simple ones. One is a practical book that is enduring, but you have to forgive the fact that it was written in the 60s. And so there's some ways of wording, everything is, you got to put it in the culture of the context. And that's one that many people may already be aware of. And it is one of the most time-tested and true books of just a practical step-by-step of what do you do as a leader to be effective. And that's called The Effective Executive by Peter Drucker. I'm sure you've heard it before. So that's kind of the more practical one. The fun one about creativity that's kind of a starter on this attribute of how do I stay creative when everybody around me wants to just do what's always been done, which eventually will lead you into austerity and into decay and decline and potential disaster, both as a country, as a company. So this perpetual innovation that everybody would like to seek. One of my favorite books on that, that's kind of a starter and it's fun to read and it's fast and easy, is called Orbiting the Giant Hairball. So that's one you won't forget the name of. So I'll just put out those two, but I want to make another statement. And this is not, I don't say this because I grew up as a missionary kid or any of that, but I will tell you, I've read thousands and thousands of leadership books. And I read, probably 3 or 4 books a week. And I've done that for over 30 years. So it adds up. And I have never, ever come across a book on leadership that was doing nothing more than recirculating, repackaging, and rewording in the context of our time what is already in the Bible. I mean, the book of Proverbs, so it talks about humility and about the need to, really be introspective and observe what's going on around you and pay attention. And when you see something you don't understand, discover, find out, pursue, be kind to other people, listen to them, respect them as much as you respect yourself. I mean, these are principles that people will sometimes discount because it is associated with religion. But the reality is very smart leaders have scribed the eternal lessons, because the one thing is true. Human nature doesn't change. We are about the same, both from a cognitive perspective and a personality perspective, as we were, when we were first created. And even though we look smarter today because we build on the successes of the past, which has a wonderful attribute of exponential discovery, the reality is that great people have written about this and they've laid down these principles that are time tested and enduring.
Yeah, great, great thoughts. Outside of work, what do you like to do to recharge?
Yeah, I like to read.
I need to be on your list of books that you're reading so you could.
Yeah. And again, for example, in this company, I have the Time to Think Club where I give out books. And so I give out books topically, for the young engineers, and I lead them along where the early books are a little more fun and interesting. And then I leave the really heavy ones for a little later on when they're getting really good at absorbing that kind of heavy information about who they are as a human being and how they can be more effective at doing whatever they're doing. But there's another component of leadership that this one gets to, and that's the physical component of it. Leaders require great energy because it is mind-numbingly hard to be a good leader. And it's not about the size of the organization. If you organize it right, you only have about 12 people or less that are really working for you. And, you're paying attention to that. You're nurturing that. You're not trying to lead 100 people or 6,000 people. You just can't do it. The human brain and the dynamics of social interaction just can't absorb it. But you need energy. And we know that the more active you are physically, the better your brain fires the synapses to learn. So what I do is I actually work out and read at the same time. Now, I can't work out really aggressively when I'm learning, whether it's listening to a book, but the more senses you can be firing when you're learning, the better you learn it. That's a known fact. So I will, try to read it out loud, write it, and see it, or I'll work out and listen so that I'm firing as many synapses in my body. And it's a physical and a mental thing. But it comes down to the free time. I do those things that keep me balanced. And that is, I eat healthy food. So I like to cook where I'm bringing in all natural and healthy things for my body. So my hobby makes me healthy. I like to spend time just being silent and thinking, okay, time to think, where I'm injecting creativity and the reading that makes you see things from other people's views. That's the creativity and not just getting into a rut. And so I like doing that, working out. So I am healthy physically and I have the energy and the strength and the endurance to tolerate all the things that happen to you as a leader. And then I the other thing I do for my free time is I invest in making friends. The more friends you have. Now, I don't need a lot of close friends. I have a lot of friends I know, but very few really close friends. But every day I invest in another connection, whether it's deep or shallow. Doesn't matter, a connection to have a network of people that can help me and that I can help because there's such value and joy in that. These are the habits that make me a strong leader and they make me happy and they make me healthy. And so I have specifically done that. And then traveling is the last one that I love to do, but it includes all of those. You're meeting new people, making new connections, learning new things, being exposed to new ideas, and out walking around. I don't take the bus, I walk or ride a bike or run.
So I have to ask you, you mentioned cooking. What's your favorite, your specialty as far as your favorite dish?
Yeah. So my wife and I cook together. We do all these things together because, again, our relationship is the foundation of my joy and happiness in our family. So Thai food is our favorite, but it's my wife that's the real, because she has a beautiful friend that's from Bangkok that taught her to cook Thai, and she has become a Thai sister. And so I benefit from that. I'm her sous chef when we cook Thai. But if it's meat, I do the meat. And she does everything else.
Okay, great. What parting advice would you give a new leader?
Yeah, I would give them the advice that humility is the most important attribute to being a good leader, because when you're humble, you recognize that you can first see the log in your own eye before you point out the sliver in your brother's eye. You know, you can really see quickly how much you hate other people's bad behavior. But how much do you hate your own behavior when it's bad? So this humility, Jane, humility is where you also are a teammate, where you don't think you know it all. You are willing to be vulnerable. These are all the true keys to being a great leader, where your team loves you. They fear you because you hold them accountable and you're tough, but they know that you love them to the point where you'd do anything for them. You'd move heaven and earth for them. And that only comes with a humble heart, a humble spirit. People can sniff out arrogance, pride, and my way or the highway in a millisecond. And they'll do the job if they have to for a paycheck. But when the chips are down or when you're in a combat situation, they'll cut and run if they don't love you and think that you are the kind of person worth taking risk for. But if you are humble, they will.
Well, I sure appreciate you taking time out today to talk to our audience. I know this is going to be helpful and wish you continued success as you lead your new venture. And it sounds like a great solution to a real problem that we have in the world today. And wish you that success and
thank you, Mark. Thoughts. Thank you for this time and the opportunity. It means a lot to me. And good luck to everybody listening. Make it practical. Do something. Try it. And if it doesn't work, try something else.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.